Hi, I'm Marco Werman, host of The World. I want to say thank you to everyone who has donated to The World's fall fundraiser so far. You hear from us all the time on the show. Our fundraiser is when we get to hear from you, like Mary from Massachusetts, who shared this. The World has been an invaluable resource to keep me connected to the wider world, she writes. I teach AP Human Geography, and it connects to course content all the time and gives me recent news to share with my students. Thank you for making my commute much more interesting. And thank you for those kind and encouraging words, Mary. From now through December 31st, we have the opportunity to double your donation. A generous donor has offered to match your gift dollar for dollar if we collectively raise $67,000. We need your help to get there. Visit theworld.org/give to donate. That's theworld.org/give. And now, the show. Russia calling Brazil, "We want our spy back." Some believe Brazilian police caught him because Moscow is getting sloppy.
They have the sort of a symptom that we call the hunters can't be hunted syndrome. They really think that they're the evil people that everybody's afraid of, and nobody would really go after them.
Think again. Also today, bad news for the Church of England. Numbers of the faithful are down, and getting them back ain't like changing radio station formats.
What, you change your music and get some kind of, you know, cool hip-hop, and then some 12-year-old's going to walk in off the street? That's not going to happen.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, we meet Afrotronics from Chad. Tradition and new technology connect listeners to the Africa of tomorrow.
To show the world who we are for real. Don't let the others define who we are.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. On the front lines of the war in Ukraine, winter is setting in. That can mean fighting in freezing rain or snow-covered rubble. For many Ukrainians, the scenes are reminiscent of World War II. Warfare has, of course, changed radically since the 1940s, and fighting a modern war in winter poses new problems, especially for Ukraine's current infrastructure. That's something diplomats are discussing in Romania right now, how NATO can better assist Ukraine this winter. That's where we start the show today. Michael Kaufman directs the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analysis. So, Michael, bottom line, how do you think the war is going to go throughout this winter?
It appears that the Russian strategy is principally defensive, to try to entrench and attempt to use the next 4 months to rebuild their force. And the Ukrainian strategy is to maintain pressure on the Russian military, try to prevent them from doing that, so that coming out of the winter, Ukraine still has the initiative and is still able to conduct offensive operations, whereas Russia is largely stuck on the defensive. But one of the outstanding questions is what might happen in the middle of the winter once the ground freezes, let's say around January. It's possible Ukraine might feel itself in a position to try to conduct some kind of offensive, although I suspect most of the fighting during the winter will consist of smaller scale attacks, heavy use of artillery and rocket systems, and we're unlikely to see a major offensive operation. But I could be wrong on that.
So today, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg warned that the Kremlin was using winter as a weapon of war against Ukraine. I mean, wars have always been fought year-round. Are Russia's attacks on Ukraine that different from what we saw in wars in generations past?
To be honest, I don't see much difference about winter in this war than any other war that I've seen take place in Europe. The general challenge winter poses is first and foremost for the average infantryman, because often the early months of winter is quite rainy and cold. And if you get wet, you can very quickly become combat ineffective. Soldiers normally struggle to stay dry in this weather until it actually becomes colder and the ground freezes. The second issue you always have is logistics. Tanks and armored fighting vehicles that are tracked can get by in the mud. But trucks and most of the vehicles you actually need to sustain a war cannot. They become bound to roads. The third challenge is that it's quite difficult to make use of cover in offensive operations because land cover disappears, right? There's no leaves on trees. Mm. And often the weather gets worse in terms of air operations as well. So the winter is not prohibitive for offensive operations, but it makes it for a much more challenging environment.
A very basic concern for soldiers on a cold battlefield is the risk of freezing to death. I mean, that used to happen in bygone wars a lot. Is that still a concern?
Yeah, I would say it's more an issue of frostbite and some of the traditional ailments you get from being deployed in trenches or having to dig in somewhere in a forest. These are problems time immemorial. Casualties go up.
When the lights go out and the internet is down in cities and towns, does that impact soldiers on the front line?
No, they usually have Starlink. It's a satellite-based internet service that's provided by a company owned by Elon Musk. And a lot of the soldiers typically will have Starlink terminals and probably generators, or at least you hope they do.
So as the NATO diplomats allied to Ukraine meet in Romania today and discuss all these concerns, what more can they actually do to protect Ukraine's infrastructure this winter?
I think the most important issue, at least in the near term, is provision of air defense to help Ukraine deal with the Russian strike campaign. And in general, if Ukrainian air defense runs low on ammunition, the only substitute they can really look to are Western-provided systems.
That's Michael Kaufman. He directs the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analysis. It's clear that when it comes to COVID, China is in a serious bind. People there are deeply frustrated with their government's restrictions and zero COVID policy, yet cases of COVID keep going up. So the government is doubling down. As part of the zero COVID regimen and to prevent the spread, China is relying exclusively on its own vaccines. We wanted to look closer at these vaccines to see what role they may be playing in China's dilemma. So we reached out to Dr. William Schaffner. He's a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville. Dr. Schaffner, how do the Chinese-made vaccines compare in effectiveness to the ones Americans are more familiar with, like Pfizer or Moderna?
Well, Marco, I think there is a distinction between the vaccines that the Chinese use and those that we use here in the Western world. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, when they were first in clinical trials, came in at 90%+ effectiveness in preventing severe disease. I would rate the Chinese vaccines at 60%-70%. Good, but not as good as the vaccines that we're using.
Right. And we're talking basically two vaccines here, the ones made by the Chinese company Sinopharm and Sinovac, correct?
Correct.
So would you say that the vaccines being used in China are part of the problem the country is facing with COVID?
The vaccines that the Chinese use are good, as I said, but they are a limitation because they're not as good as preventing severe disease. And that's what all of these vaccines are designed to do, to prevent severe disease. They're not as good at preventing transmission from one person to another.
So for the sake of argument, doctor, if China did not have a zero COVID strategy, would the Chinese COVID vaccines be sufficient to contain the pandemic and increase population immunity?
Well, Marco, these vaccines have been good, and they have been used in a number of other countries. You know, the Chinese have done a fair amount of vaccine diplomacy, making vaccines available to many countries at a reduced price. Countries such as Chile, for example, have used the Chinese vaccines to very good effect.
Is it the case, though, that other countries are having more success in China with Chinese-made vaccines, and why is that?
Well, without the lockdown, you obviously also have the impact of the virus itself going around infecting people and thereby creating some immunity on that basis. I think the basis of the zero COVID strategy is they were going to do such a good job in preventing infection that they would spare a lot of illness, and they were going to, quote, quote, out-vaccinate and outlast the virus. But the virus isn't going anywhere. It's eager to get into China and spread. And so I think they're now betwixt the proverbial rock and a hard place. How do you open up their society economically and socially and still protect the maximum number of people, particularly so if they remain committed to their own vaccines?
So what are the options at this point for the Chinese government, doctor? And if they don't move to a different vaccine, what's your view of how they should be thinking about their own vaccines as part of their strategy?
Well, I think one of the things they could consider on a regional basis, because they have an enormous population, you can't do it over the entire country simultaneously, is in slowly opening up the society and then flooding that area with their vaccines to provide the best vaccine protection. And they ought to be able to control that slowly opening up because they have much more social control in China. And then they could try to do this region by region by region and see if it works.
Dr. William Schaffner is a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Schaffner, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
This next story is about a new law in Spain that punishes sex offenders. A warning, some of the events that led to the legislation are disturbing and may not be suitable for all our listeners. The new law is also having some unintended consequences. It raises the maximum jail time for rape, but lowers the minimum time for other offenses. And it's retroactive, which means some sex offenders are being released immediately. From Barcelona, Jerry Haddon reports.
In 2016, five men who called themselves La Manada, or the Pack, gang-raped a woman and filmed it. In the footage shown at their trial, the woman's lying still, eyes shut, not resisting. Despite the images, the men were acquitted of rape, because under the law then, rape had to involve violence or intimidation. Judges said they saw no proof of either. So instead of 25 years in prison, the men got 9 on a lesser charge of sexual abuse. The streets of Spain exploded with anger. Eventually, Spain's top criminal court bumped the men's sentences to 15 years, but for then-new Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez, it wasn't enough.
Ese machismo bárbaro que subsiste en lo peor de la manada.
We need to do away with the barbarous machismo of the groups like the PAC, he told voters at the time, and with the humiliation of victims, he said, who are often blamed for being raped. Fast forward to October of this year, and Sánchez's center-left government passes what it hails as a tougher law. University of Barcelona law professor Ujala Yoshi says in some respects it is. For one, it requires explicit consent before sexual relations. The maximum sentence for rape is now longer, she says, and it makes earning parole harder for convicts. The changes put Spain among the strictest countries when it comes to rape, and it establishes all kinds of services for victims, from safe houses to legal assistance. But with lesser sex crimes, the new law stumbles. Because first, lawmakers wrapped all lesser offenses into one category, ranging from, say, touching someone against their will to having an affair with a minor. Previously, some of those crimes had shorter minimum sentences. Now, those shorter sentences apply to them all. Let's say I get a minimum sentence of 4 years for a certain offense, says Yoshi. But now the minimum sentence is 2 years. I'm going to ask for my sentence to reflect that, she says. This is what's causing the chaos. Since the law's passage in October, hundreds of lawyers have lined up to demand lighter sentences for their sex offender clients. Some judges fear the system could collapse under the pressure. Many women, like this university student, Aina Muelas, say they're alarmed. The convicts should serve their time, she says. They're no doubt happy to have their sentences reduced, but for us women who stand to be hurt, she says, this is a blow. Spain's Minister for Equality, Irene Montero, has tried to calm concerns, saying only a male chauvinist judge would actually lower a sex offender's sentence. We are going to educate the judiciary, she said. But Professor Yoshi says Spanish penal law is clear. If a prison sentence is lowered for a crime, she says, a convict already behind bars for that crime has the legal right to that lower sentence, even retroactively. That's because our Constitution is oriented toward rehabilitating criminals, she says. Government lawmakers admit the sentencing snafu was an oversight. Political opponents have pounced. Member of Parliament Carla Toscana from the far-right Vox Party delivered an I told you so to legislators this week. We warned you, she said. You called it fake news. Well, releases from jail have already happened, and who knows how many more are coming. Spain's Attorney General's office has stepped into the fray, saying it will oppose any sentence reductions. But regional AGs appear to be moving forward, lowering jail time on request. Legal experts say the government's only hope in halting the sentence reductions lies with the nation's highest court. But it could take weeks for the case to reach the bench, enough time, some worry, for hundreds more sex offenders to have their jail terms shortened. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. If you look at a pie chart of where greenhouse gas emissions come from, a big slice comes from the beef industry. It accounts for 7% of global emissions. That's largely from cows burping out methane, but also production and use of fossil fuels to fertilize cow feed and clearing forests for cattle to graze on. In a remote corner of Colombia, there's a large cattle ranch that's aiming to be a net positive for the environment. It's doing that by using a new kind of grass for pasture land. From Colombia, Manuel Rueda reports.
The San Jose Ranch is located on a remote stretch of Colombia's eastern plains. It has its own runway for small aircraft and 5,000 cows that are munching on a special kind of grass called coronivia.
The key of this plant is that it is able to grow very deep root systems.
That's Jacob Arango. He's a biologist at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, which bred coronivia and has studied how it performs at the San Jose Ranch.
We have calculated that it's able to store 15% more carbon than the natural pasture that is growing here.
He's also found that it can capture and store large amounts of nitrogen after cows release it in their urine. That slows down emissions of nitrous oxide into the atmosphere.
So we have calculated that it's between 2.5 to 10-fold reduction in terms of nitrous oxide emissions.
In South America, cattle ranchers often clear forests for pasture land, which emits large amounts of carbon. But this ranch currently soaks up more greenhouse gases than its cattle emit. And it can feed more cattle than ranches that use regular kinds of grass, 17 times more on the same amount of land. Paulo Moreira is the ranch's CEO.
In terms of emissions, it is true and will always be true that the animals emit gases. But when you combine that with a system that is able to sequestrate more gases than what those animals are emitting, then it becomes very interesting. And that's what we have achieved here.
Moreira isn't the only one trying to reduce the beef industry's environmental hoofprint. In the United States, some ranchers are promoting regenerative grazing. Instead of planting a monocrop of grass for feed, cattle are rotated on fields of native species. This helps cows to be healthier while reducing emissions, says Alan Williams, a rancher and consultant from South Carolina.
It sequesters a whole lot more carbon, just like the prairies and the native grasslands once did. We're recreating the carbon sinks through recreating the diversity of plant species.
In Colombia, Moreira and his business partner, a former banker, have raised millions of dollars to launch their eco-friendly ranch. Buying and planting the coronivia grass is more expensive than the traditional methods of cattle ranching used here. Moreira says they want to sell their meat in the United States, where the demand for grass-fed beef is growing.
You go to Whole Food markets today, you see cage-free, you see animal well-being, no use of preventive hormones. What we are trying to do here is to put all those attributes into the meat that we produce.
Currently, most cows in the U.S. are grain-fed and spend most of their lives in feedlots, but that's changing. Sales of grass-fed beef in the United States have skyrocketed. Williams estimates that they jumped from $3 million in 2003 to $8 billion last year.
Most grain-fed beef in the U.S. today, due to the finishing rations that they're on, has sort of a bland flavor. And we've had many, many consumers that have told us that, oh, wow, this grass-fed beef tastes like the beef I used to eat when I was growing up. You know, I like this.
The San Jose Ranch needs to boost production for its eco-friendly but costly business model to work. So the company's looking for 200 investors to buy plots of land in Colombia's eastern plains. Moreira says the plan is for each ranch to sustain 900 cows that will be raised with coronivia grass.
There's this huge area that is very appropriate for cattle without the need to cut trees. I think Colombia has a jewel in its hands.
If the project succeeds, the San Jose Ranch could become the largest producer of carbon-neutral cattle in South America. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Vichada, Colombia.
The release of the blockbuster film Wakanda Forever is a sequel to the Black Panther story. Both fall under the widely encompassing idea of Afrofuturism. There's Afrofuturism cinema, literature, design, also Afrofuturism festivals. For many people in the African diaspora, it has a lot to do with reconnecting with ancestry, a past that for many millions was severed because of slavery. For many Africans on the continent today, Afrofuturism is more about what its name suggests, the future.
حبوا دار القوية وهبية يمين ندانا في أرض نشب وأرض خيش فذا كون جينا حجرك ولا قايف قايف يمين الأمانة.
This is a band from Chad, the vast nation in the Sahara Desert. Afrotronics is the name. It's a brainchild of Caleb Ritmobaye.
The way we define Afrofuturism is for Africans, it's a really connecting in different ways to who we are, spiritual way, in cultural way. We would like with this vision to have impact on the future.
Ritmobaye now is Afrotronics, his artist name. With Chad as his bass, Afrotronics touring has put him in the role of go-between for two audiences, Africans on the continent and across the diaspora, managing an exchange of ideas between the two. Afrotronics wants people on the continent to know that Afrofuturism is theirs to create.
This is how I see Africa. This is how Africa is, talking to the diaspora and then back to the new generations in Africa and saying that you are the one to show the world who we are for real. Don't let the others define who we are.
The sound may be a product of high tech, but it's rooted in traditional rhythms, even produced by his own family.
And I use samples, the authentic, my grandmother, authentic vocals, and this is a new movement that is really starting taking over in Africa. You see this a lot in Kenya, Zanzibar, when I was there in 2017, and great movements in South Africa, and now in Central Africa with Cameroon, some people in Niger. So I think this is the new African new wave.
Run away, fly away. To a place where I can breathe, take me higher. Where serenity is easy to breathe. Run away.
New music there from Afrotronics from Chad. The track is called Runaway Ta. More stories from around the globe still coming your way. You're listening to The World. A song in Ukraine, 100 years old. It has become an unofficial anthem. When the city of Kherson was recently liberated from Russian troops, Ukrainians gathered that night in the city center.
And they sang this song right at the top of their lungs to kind of proclaim their freedom. It's incredibly moving.
We'll hear it and what it means still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The uprising in Iran is entering its third month. Dissidents are finding few places to run for safety. Iranians can go to Turkey without a visa, but they're facing increasing online threats for opposing Tehran. The Iranian regime has also kidnapped and killed dissidents in Turkey. Reporter Fariba Nawa in Istanbul has been documenting these cases and has our story.
Mahshid Nazimi is a dissident refugee from Iran. She came to Turkey 8 years ago and has applied for asylum to a third country. She made this video a few weeks ago, as soon as she was detained in an immigration office in western Turkey. She says, I came to my local immigration office because they called me and said I needed to come in and sign something for my case. Nazimi holds back tears. Her voice shakes in a frightened 47-second plea to whoever is going to listen. She says, I thought maybe it had to do something with the complaint that I had reported to the police a few nights back, that I was followed and threatened by someone in a car. But when I came in this morning, they detained me, and right now, I'm in a holding area. Look, This is my current condition. Then she points the camera at an empty room with a closed glass door. Nazemi says tomorrow they'll take her to a deportation camp. That's where she is now. If it wasn't for this video, Nazemi could have disappeared into Turkey's labyrinth of detention camps intended for undocumented migrants. But the video was shared widely in the Iranian community in Turkey and among the foreign press. Nazemi got a lawyer and appealed the deportation order. Nazemi's boyfriend, Amin Zaidi, says her future is unknown and Turkey has denied the appeal. The immigration officer accused Nazemi of using a fake ID card in Turkey. A bogus charge, Zahidi says. She didn't need to use a fake card because she was a documented refugee. But Zahidi believes Turkey's working with Iran to punish his girlfriend. Zahidi tells me in a voice message from Western Turkey that Nazemi was criticizing the Iranian regime on opposition TV and radio in reference to her sister, Puran Nazemi, a renowned women's rights activist currently imprisoned in Iran. It was a few days after those media appearances that Nazemi said she was threatened. Zahidi fills in more of the details. He says Mahshid Nazemi left her home in western Turkey about 7 p.m. to get groceries when a car with tinted windows and a blank plate followed her. A man came out of the car and cursed her. He told Nazemi if she didn't stop talking to the press, she would be kidnapped back to Iran and treated like her sister. This scene may sound like something out of Hollywood, but it can become reality for outspoken dissidents in Turkey. Dissidents say if the regime can't get them in Turkey, they will target their families inside Iran. The Turkish government protects some dissidents, but Iranians say only if it serves Turkey's interest. Shaheen Milani is the executive director of Iran Human Rights Documentation Center based in the U.S.
The Iranian government has assassinated and kidnapped dissidents in Turkey. So those Iranians who are currently residing in Turkey and seeking asylum, they have a legitimate reason to be worried.
Milani says many Iranians are trying to get to another country as soon as possible, but that's been difficult.
The Turkish authorities have been very slow in processing their cases.
Some cases end in tragedy, like Mohammad Shabani's. On October 9, Shabani's friends say he ended up in the hospital after reports that he had jumped from the fourth floor of his home near Izmir with slit wrists. He died after 2 weeks in a coma.
In the last 3 months, he was threatened to phone calls, ordering him to get back to Iran.
Adil Bianbangard Javan was in touch with Shabani from California. They were friends from a distance, sharing a love for Persian poetry.
His family also were threatened because Muhammad was talking in the clubhouse room against the governments of Iran most days.
Shabani was a former provincial government official in Shiraz who opposed the hardline regime. In 2018, after he was released from prison in Iran, Shabani paid smugglers to come to Turkey. As Shabani waited for asylum here, he became more hopeless.
He told me several times during the last 2 months that he has two choices, going back to Iran or ending his life in Turkey. Everything about his death is hazy. Nobody knows whether it was an assassination by the regime of Iran or a suicide.
Shabani's family took him back to Iran to bury him. Javan says regardless of how his friend died, he holds the Iranian regime responsible for pushing Shabani to a desperate end. For The World, I'm Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
Some interesting findings in the UK following the release of its latest census. Christianity is officially a minority religion in both England and Wales. Church attendance is down significantly, and the number of people identifying as having no religion is up nearly 15%. Joining me now is Abby Day. She's a professor of race, faith, and culture at Goldsmiths University of London. What's your reaction to this news, Abby? Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised at all. In fact, last year when the census was delivered to people to mark their choices, I was interviewed then and I said I thought that the result would show that Christianity would have dropped to less than 50%, because that's the pattern that has been going on for the last few decades.
Is there a generational aspect to these results?
Mostly it is generational. So what we see is that the older members who were very practicing and went every Sunday, and to them it was quite important, and it was important because it represented the church was the nation, and it was the queen, and it was country. And then their baby boomer children did not follow in their footsteps, and we've seen this happen. And so what we know, I guess most of what we know about religion transmission is it happens in families. So if you're not raised to be religious, it's very unlikely you will be.
Mm. So the Church of England, as the established Christian faith in England, what kind of position has it held in people's lives historically, but especially over the last 100 years?
It does have a strange sort of relationship with the country because it has some structural relationships. So in the House of Lords, which is the sort of second level government, there are 26 places that historically for centuries have been reserved for the senior leaders of the Church of England, the bishops. And therefore, they have an impact on some of the legislation that's going through. For example, they voted consistently against same-sex marriage. They were very much against having women priests and women bishops over the years. So they do have an effect on the legislation. And also, about a third of primary schools are run by the Church of England. So there's this kind of background effect that people sort of are semi-aware of, but it's there.
So does the census tell us whether another faith or faiths have overtaken Christianity in numbers, or are we talking about just an overall decrease in Christian believers?
Oh, we're talking about overall decrease. The other faiths are very, very small in comparison. The second biggest category on the census is the category of no religion. That's the one that is really increasing.
Has there been any discussion of how to bring people back to the church? I mean, do you think anything can be done about that?
Oh, the church discusses it all the time inwardly. Yeah, they're very concerned about it. No, I don't, because it's generational. You know, I mean, and because they have lost these at least two generations, I don't think that's recoverable. I don't see any way that it could be recoverable. And also, young people from the baby boomers onwards have very different sets of morals. You know, in some ways, are much more ethical. They really lashed out against, certainly the baby boomers, lashed out against the church's stand on things like gender equality, sexual equality. The Church of England's head, Welby, admitted not long ago that the Church of England was institutionally racist. So who wants to belong to that?
The 2021 census results also reveal that the white population of England is on the decline, down from 86% to 81%. I mean, it's still a large majority, but how do you frame that drop, especially in the wake of anti-immigration rhetoric of the past few years, not to mention the very pro-English Brexit deal?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's very worrying. And you see the same thing, right? I mean, you do see the same thing. There is a very ugly rise in white nationalism. And some people tie that to Christianity. Some people would say, we're a Christian country. But what they mean is, we don't want any people who are of different color to come in here. So there's a very sort of dark side to this, isn't there? A kind of nationalistic, ugly side that has fueled war and fueled conflicts. And I think we have to keep a close eye on that.
Abby, it's a personal question, but seems apt in this conversation. Do you go to church?
No, I'm typically one of those baby boomers. I used to when I was younger and then just sort of gradually drifted away. I study it, but I don't go, except when I'm studying it.
Is that also kind of a function of the home in your case?
Well, no. I mean, I was raised, like most people in my generation, raised Church of England, you know, like a lot of people in my generation. So I think I'm quite representative of that generation, that I didn't fight against the church. I just, as most people did, just thought, well, it's increasingly irrelevant. And then as I got older, I felt like a lot of baby boomers I interviewed, I felt that the church or Christianity can be very individually focused. You know, so much is about personal salvation. And that's sort of counter to how a lot of people want to live in a society where they want more to live in a society of collaboration, cooperation. And I think the focus on the individual is what turned a lot of people off. And people wanted to talk more about societies and communities and, you know, bigger questions.
Abby Day is a professor of race, faith, and culture at Goldsmiths, University of London. She's also the author of a new book called Why Baby Boomers Turned from Religion, Shaping Belief and Belonging. Abby, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
When Russia first invaded Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin said that Ukrainians and Russians are one people. He said the Ukrainian state was not real, that it was created out of thin air with the Soviet Union. In Ukraine, Putin's twisted claims are seen as an attempt to erase the country's culture and history. Net result, Ukrainian pride and patriotism are swelling. The World's Daniel Hoffman has this story about one Ukrainian song that has become a symbol of resistance.
Earlier this month, when Ukraine's military liberated Kherson City in southern Ukraine, residents took to the streets in celebration. They waved Ukrainian flags, honked horns, and sang the national anthem. There's another song, though, that's become a kind of second anthem. People sang it all around Kherson City when it was liberated. They sang it while standing in line to get clean water, and here in the town square as kids jumped around and danced. The song is called Oy Uluzi Chervona Kalina. Oy Uluzi
Chervona Kalina. So the title literally just means, oh, the red viburnum in the meadow, right? It sounds perfectly innocent, but then it goes from there to kind of be a deeply patriotic song about defending Ukraine from invaders.
That's Maria Sinavitsky. She's a professor of anthropology and music at Bard College. The Chervona Kalina, or red viburnum, is a leafy shrub peppered with clusters of blood-red berries. Sinavitsky says the Kalina is closely identified with Ukrainian poetry and music.
Often Ukrainian folkloric songs will open with a naturalistic image, something kind of innocent sounding, a tree, a bird, or a kalina very often. And from that kind of opening image, you unspool a kind of metaphor or a story about politics or about the complexities of life. And that's the case here too.
Most believe the lyrics were inspired by a song from the 17th century.
But it's in 1914 or so that a Ukrainian composer adds the verses that we still sing today. And that's when it really becomes closely associated with the Sich riflemen, who were this Ukrainian unit inside of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time.
In 1914, what is now Ukraine was divided among neighboring countries, including Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But around World War I, some Ukrainians hoped to establish an independent country. Here's Andriy Zerenyuk. He's a history professor at the University of Winnipeg.
This was the original hope of Ukrainians, of the Ukrainian national movement when they entered the war, right? They believed that this war could become a revolution and would change the geopolitics in Eastern Europe.
But after the war, Ukraine was folded into the Soviet Union. And under that system, many Ukrainian patriotic songs like Chervona Kalina were banned.
This one was too nationalist. It was banned because it was connected with this Ukrainian national liberation struggle. And then it reappeared at the end of the 1980s.
Just a few years later, the Soviet Union collapsed and an independent Ukraine emerged. Maria Sinavitsky says the song had never really left the memory of Ukrainians.
What is, of course, new and striking in this moment is the degree to which, a few days after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia, it became a viral hit and it really pinged around the world.
That's because musician Andriy Khlivnyuk, lead singer of the Ukrainian band Boombox, had posted his version of the song on Instagram. Ой, Улузі, червона калина,
похилилася. You see Khlivnyuk in military fatigues, standing in front of this iconic site in downtown Kyiv, the St. Sophia Cathedral Complex. And he sings it in a very kind of boomboxy way. You know, fans of the band would recognize it.
Червону калину підіймемо. But even as this version of the song goes viral, songs like Chervona Kalina are still banned in Russian-occupied territories. People have been fined or even arrested for singing it. And when Ukrainian territory is liberated...
You see these scenes from like recently liberated Kherson where people literally on the very first night built a huge bonfire in the center of town because there's no electricity. And they sang this song right at the top of their lungs to kind of proclaim their freedom. It's incredibly moving.
This war has made Chervona Kalina even more meaningful for many Ukrainians, representing their defiance in the face of Russia's invasion. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Chances are you or one of your friends has a story about a really bad internship, but did it land anybody in the slammer and spark an international incident? I hope not, but that's pretty much what happened to Victor Mula Ferreira. He was carrying a Brazilian passport when he applied to be an intern at the International Criminal Court. The reality was this. His real name, Sergei Cherkasov, a spy for Russian military intelligence, the GRU. He got caught trying to infiltrate the International Criminal Court, not interning there. Now he's in a Brazilian jail, and Russia wants their human asset back. And that's where this story gets even crazier. Reporter Christo Grozev uncovered the latest twist in this caper. He is the lead Russia investigator for the online investigative journalism outlet Bellingcat and joins us from Vienna. Christo, where does Russia's quest to rescue Cherkasov actually begin? How did they reach out to the Brazilian government?
So Russia approached the Brazilian prosecution authorities on the 23rd of June this year. And they provided a whole pack of documents saying, okay, by the way, you've got somebody that we're looking for. And here's about 50 pages of indictment documents on this person. We recognize he's a Russian. We recognize he's not who he said he was. Mm-hmm. So forget about that Brazilian identity. He's Sergei Cherkasov. But no, he's not the GRU, a military intelligence officer. Instead, he's a long-sought criminal in Russia, and we've been looking for him for about 12 years now. They provided what they claimed was evidence that there had been a criminal drug smuggling gang where he was one of the original members and that he helped import and smuggle drugs from Tajikistan into Russia and then sell them on the Russian market. And then he somehow vanished, and they've been looking for him ever since.
Prior to these documents, had there been any notion or suspicion that Cherkasov was running heroin?
Well, clearly not. This is obviously a fake story, and it is obvious. It becomes obvious from the documents that the Russians presented themselves. First of all, there are grammar mistakes in the documents that actually suggest that his name was copied and pasted from other places. They used an existing indictment against other people, all of whom are named here in this document, and they're all in jail, sitting in jail for years already. And they just decided to add his name retroactively to an existing indictment, totally butchering the timeline of the indictment and also the logic and the grammar, as I just said. He has been going in and back Russia, traveling under his original name, between 2015 and December 2021, and the Russians were never, ever interested in him until he was arrested in Brazil.
How much time would Cherkasov face for these drug charges if they are real?
Well, if they were real, the time that he would have to spend would be relatable to the volume of drugs that he imported. We calculated that he would have to face about 19 years of jail time in Russia.
19, and isn't that a sentence that would be longer than the one he's facing in Brazil, which is 15 years, right?
Well, abusing the system of Brazil identity documents, he would probably be out in about 4 to 5 years. So clearly, he has a much better deal in Brazil than in Russia, which makes it implausible that he has voluntarily agreed to confess to all of the charges from the Russians and volunteered to fly to Russia to serve up his sentence.
So how did you figure this all out, Christo?
Well, we learned the trade of accessing Russian databases, Russian government-run databases. The Russian government is extremely corrupt, and you can find a lot of these databases available on Telegram channels. And essentially, you can just search for data traders in Russia, and you should get real-time data from travel databases, from passport databases. So what we did here is we had already this guy on our radar because he was arrested in April of this year. His name was published by the Dutch authorities in June, and we were able to retrace and recreate his whole background, his whole history, using tools such as reverse face recognition. We found that he was actually a soldier in a military cadet school in Kaliningrad. We found that he was trained for this military espionage business at the Moscow GRU Academy in 2006, and then he left 2010 under this fake Brazilian identity. What is more interesting even is that we found through him a whole nest of other illegal spies, long-term sleeper agents that the Russians have placed in the United States, in Latin America, and it all came via him, and we're planning actually to out a lot of these in the next couple of weeks.
That's extraordinary. I mean, all of this makes the GRU seem like a really porous organization, not some threatening military intelligence operation.
Well, it is threatening. I mean, they've been actually poisoning and killing people and exploding munition facilities across Europe. What they are not, however, is subtle. I mean, they have to live by very, very strict bureaucratic rules of their organization. These rules don't seem to have been updated since the 80s. And they leave a lot of traces that previously would not have been discovered by open source investigators like us. But now they are being found quite easily. So I think they just haven't updated themselves to the 21st century.
Is the GRU getting sloppy?
Yes, I would say every aspect of the Russian economy has become much less efficient than it was before. The GRU are getting sloppier because they have the sort of a symptom that we call the hunters can't be hunted syndrome. Mm. They really think that they're the evil people that everybody's afraid of, and nobody would really go after them. And this has changed over the last 5 years.
More to come, yes?
Yes, we promise.
Christo Grozev is Bellingcat's lead investigator on Russia. He broke the story of Russia's extradition request for their lost spy in Brazil. Christo joined us from Vienna. Christo, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's conclude our proceedings today down under.
It's one of the world's greatest living wonders.
Australia's Great Barrier Reef. In this big screen IMAX immersion, we see vacationing scuba divers gliding through an underwater paradise. They're mingling with multicolored fishes and sea turtles in a forest of corals. This living structure, 1,400 miles long, was named a World Heritage Site in 1981. Great Barrier Reef tourism is a multi-billion dollar industry for Australia. It supports tens of thousands of jobs, but all that could change.
The United Nations has recommended the Great Barrier Reef be listed as a World Heritage Site in danger.
A UN report card issued this week says Australia is not doing enough to combat climate change, coastal development, or the pollution it causes. Australia's Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek fired back. She told Sky News that there's no need for UNESCO to now single out the Great Barrier Reef because there's been a change in government.
And in fact, in the 6 months since coming to office, the Australian Marine Conservation Society says that the new government has done more in this 6 months than the previous government did in 9 years.
Australia is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into conservation efforts. Whether it is doing enough, that will be decided by a UNESCO World Heritage Committee meeting next year. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. Thanks for being with us. A quick note before we go. Now through December 31st, your donation to the World's fall fundraiser will go twice as far. A generous donor is offered to match your gift dollar for dollar up to $67,000. So if you give $100, the World will receive $200. This is a big deal for us. I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. Again, that's theworld.org/give. Thanks very much.